Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Just one guest up today, Diane Ravitch, the former conservative educational reformer turned critic of that whole testing and privatization agenda that is now not only the province of the Republican Party, but the Obama administration as well. Since I want to say a few words about Ravitch and education before playing the interview, only a few brief comments on the economic news. One, it looks like American consumers are going back to their free spending ways. They haven't yet reached the stage of irrational exuberance, but the preliminary reports on shopping in March suggest that it was one of the best months in a decade. How people are funding this is beyond me. The job market is still weak, with poor prospects for a serious recovery anytime soon. Household balance sheets still stink, with the asset side down for most middle-income families. Their principal asset is typically their house, whose price may well still be sinking, and the liability side is still high. Mortgage and credit card debt shrinking mildly, but from very elevated levels. It's a little scary, actually. I've been sounding off a lot about how our elite has learned nothing from the crisis. Now it's looking like everyone else is in the same boat. Oh, and Greece is back in trouble again. A couple of weeks ago, the EU announced some sort of rescue package for Greece, but aside from an austerity program to be imposed on the masses, there wasn't much substance to it. Now the markets are back to selling Greek bonds and making financial life miserable for that country. It looks like Greece, unlike the USA, doesn't have the luxury of learning nothing from crisis, though my guess is that the US exemption won't last forever. Okay, now to Diane Ravitch. Diane Ravitch is a historian of education and an education policy specialist. She got famous for her conservative ties. She served in the George H.W. Bush administration and found herself signing on with the whole Republican schools agenda. Choice, testing, vouchers, and privatization. Several years ago, she had a change of heart and mind of the sort that's very rare in public life. She realized that the policies she'd been promoting were not only ineffective, they were outright destructive. She's now out with a new book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, published by BASIC. It's a very good book. It's a detailed, smart, yet very readable analysis of the controversies around public education today, written with a historian's sense that all this didn't begin the day before yesterday. Before playing the interview, recorded earlier in the week, I want to underscore a couple of points. First, while the whole testing and choice agenda, one that ultimately tends towards the privatization of the public school system, was once a Republican obsession, it's now become a bipartisan affair. The Obama administration hasn't merely continued the Bush education agenda. In many ways, they've intensified it. With the Republicans, it's easy to be alarmed by the notion of education policy being set by absolute yahoos who not only don't read books but are suspicious of those who do. And by that, I don't mean to deny that there are serious conservative intellectuals. There are. I'm thinking strictly of politicians like George W. Bush and his cabinet and most of the Republican congressional delegation. But Obama is far from a yahoo, and so too are most of the people who surround him. Though not yahoos, they are a bunch of centrist technocrats. Technocrats are usually obsessed with what they like to call metrics, but they're pushing policies like school choice, charter schools, and vouchers that have absolutely no basis in experience. There's no evidence that they improve educational outcomes. The only reasons I can think of for this now bipartisan consensus is that privatizing schools is a way of saving money, and that the whole notion of choice and competition fits in nicely with reigning bourgeois ideology. Note that the business and political elite that is pushing this agenda doesn't, for the most part, send its own kids to these public schools. They send their kids to private schools, with rigorous traditional curricula, in many cases, a progressive approach to education. A regime of basic skills and military discipline isn't good enough for their kids, just for the masses. Maybe that's another reason for this agenda, producing better cogs for the economic machine, but it's going to make us dumber. During the interview, I mentioned the similarity of Education Secretary Arne Duncan's comments in Hurricane Katrina's beneficial effects on the public school system of New Orleans to those of right-wing icon Milton Friedman. I'm not exaggerating. In January, Duncan called Katrina the best thing that happened to the education system in New Orleans. That's a direct quote, not a paraphrase. That's because it forced charter schools and the rest of the agenda onto the city. And here's what Milton Friedman wrote in the Wall Street Journal in December 2005. Most New Orleans schools are in ruins, as are the homes of the children who attended them. The children are now scattered all over the country. This is a tragedy. It is also an opportunity to radically reform the educational system. That's the end of the quote from Friedman. Well, Friedman posthumously got that opportunity. But who would have guessed that a Democratic administration would be so enthusiastically pushing his program? Obama has erased what was once one of the surviving major differences between the two parties, education policy. And a second point. Ravitch writes and talks about the central role played by a handful of very rich foundations in pushing the school's agenda. The sinister role of foundations, unaccountable bodies run by rich people and their hired hands, in public life is rarely talked about. Part of the reason for that is that many of the people who might talk about them, and many of the forums that might publicize that talk, are on the foundation dole or would like to be. I'm not, and I'll never miss an opportunity to point out how toxic these things are. Okay, on to the interview. Apologies that my questions in this interview sound like they were filed from the bottom of a well. Not sure why that happened, but it won't happen again. Okay, Diane Ravitch. Welcome, Diane Ravitch. I don't want to spend too much time on the story of your conversion, but it does attract a lot of interest. You were really never a movement conservative in the sense that people you know, gathered around William Buckley in the mid-50s and 60s were.
No. In fact, I've never published anything for the National Review, and movement conservatives are very quick to tell you that I was never a movement conservative.
But give us the précis of your political evolution. You started as a Democrat, right?
Well, I was a Democrat all my life. I was born to Yellow Dog Democrats. I mean, the kind who, I guess the line is that they will be a Democrat till the last dog dies. And I was not politically active, although I did work in the campaign of John F. Kennedy and various other presidential candidates. But basically, I've been devoted to education since the late 1960s when I started in this field. And when I was invited to be Assistant Secretary of Education by Lamour Alexander, I thought, oh, you know, this sounds like fun, and decided to do it. And at that point, I remained a Democrat. In fact, I went around telling everybody during the confirmation process that I was a Democrat and that I had no plans to change my registration. Since then, however, I decided that I would prefer to be an independent, and that's what I have been now for, I guess, the last 10 years.
How did choice and accountability get to be so identified with conservative educational policy?
Well, choice and accountability were really the fundamental Republican agenda since Ronald Reagan. And it had a lot to do with the association of Republicans with the business world and with Democrats, on the other hand, with the unions, and specifically the teachers' unions. The way that sort of maybe oversimplified, but the way I defined the difference is that Republicans believed in accountability because if you measured, you would see if you're moving forward or not, and that there should be some accountability, also meaning that there would be consequences, and that this would incentivize people to do the right thing. Choice, meaning that with more choices, you'd have a market, and the Republicans and conservatives believe in markets. The Democrats, on the other hand, have had a policy of equity and professionalism, investing in teacher professional development. But also more important than that was equity, the idea that the role of federal government was to help to level the playing field for poor children and to send money to districts and schools where the poor children were enrolled in hopes that that would make a difference.
And this whole bandwagon really got rolling with the release of the Nation at Risk report back in 1983. That now, I think, is remembered by people who don't study these things carefully as a kind of manifesto coming out of the political right. But in reading your book, I was reminded that it was not easily mapped onto present-day conservative educational philosophy, right?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. It came out during the Reagan administration, so people thought it was a Reagan manifesto, but in fact, Reagan was never liked the report. He wanted a report that would say something like, "We need vouchers and we need school prayer," but it doesn't say a word about either. It really is about things that schools could do, should do, and I still think should do, and that is to have a strong basic curriculum, not just basic skills, but a curriculum that includes the arts and science and the whole range of subjects that kids ought to study. Better prepared teachers, better teaching materials, better paid teachers. I mean, across the board, it has what I consider to be very sensible mainstream solutions. And conservatives today tend to look on it and say, well, that failed. It just proves we need more choice and more accountability, which neither of which was championed by the Nation at Risk report.
That report used some pretty strong language, which is what got such attention. It was not the typical bureaucratic report that gets filed in the shelves and forgotten. Do you accept that sense of alarm that expressed 25, almost 30 years ago, that we are really in an educational crisis and that it threatens our prosperity and our democracy?
Well, you know, I think that they could probably reissue that report today, and I think that in a way it's even truer today than it was then. I think it was then fueled by a sense that the Japanese economy was getting stronger and overtaking us. I think that in some ways we've seen with its advent of globalization even more jobs leaving the country, not for Japan, obviously, but for countries that have a lower wage scale. And we're at risk in many ways. So I do think that the sense of crisis was not misplaced, because the crisis was about we're not educating kids well enough and we're not educating enough kids. And so I think, yeah, that's right. You could argue, and I guess anyone who studied the history of education would say, that we've had a crisis probably in every decade of the 20th century. And a lot of the crisis talk is intended by educators to say, pay more attention, let's do it right, let's get more money to do it right. And educators have always traded in the crisis talk. I think what's happened more recently, however, is that the crisis talk has been turned against educators for an agenda that is really very hostile to education.
How much of a problem, or educational problem, or achievement problem, or capabilities problem, is the fault of the schools, and how much of it is a broader social problem? For example, great degrees of inequality in the society, inequality of income, inequality of school districts, a broader culture that is rather anti-intellectual. I mean, how much of it is the problem of the schools, and how much of it is a broader problem of our social system?
Well, I do believe that we have today, and probably always have, schools that reflect society. And what's happening right now, and which is a tragedy, is that the kind of the dominant mantra is fire teachers, fire teachers. If teachers don't get 100% proficiency from everybody, they're bad teachers, fire them. This is ridiculous, because the schools are getting kids who arrive, many of them not speaking English, many of them living in terrible poverty, and so much of the crisis talk today is meant to say poverty doesn't matter, income inequality doesn't matter. The fact that we have kids not speaking English or kids coming from very shattered homes and from communities where there are no jobs, that doesn't matter either. Let's focus it all on teachers. So there's a kind of mean utopianism that's being applied across the board to education today. And I can't remember a time in my life, Ari, even in my studies, where teachers were more disrespected and more frightened of the future.
Let's step back into history to figure out how we got to this present-day obsession with accountability and testing. You have a chapter devoted to District 2 in New York City, which is very important in the evolution of all this. Tell us the story of District 2.
Well, District 2 is the most affluent district in the city of New York, and they had wonderful teachers and principals. And the district over 10 years, over a period from the late 80s to late 90s, improved its test scores. And the story got out because there were a number of scholars, very eminent scholars, studying the progress of District 2. The story got out in the national media that District 2 was a miraculous district. It was said erroneously that it was an impoverished district, and that this deeply impoverished district had somehow managed to become number 2 in the city because of its reading program. Well, the problem with this was that the reformers, or the so-called reformers, the business leaders, heard about this miraculous district, and they said, aha, we finally have the formula. We'll force everybody to do that reading program. It's called balanced literacy. And balanced literacy has its advocates and its critics, but it turns out, in my reading of the story, that, of course, District 2 was not impoverished. It was not even typical of New York City. It had a predominant, overwhelming number of both white and Asian kids, a very high-income district. And its scores pretty much reflected the demographics of the district. It was not an outlier district except for how favored it was in terms of income and demographics. But somehow the story about the miraculous transformation attributable to balanced literacy then traveled to San Diego. And San Diego happened to be a pretty good urban district, But the business leadership there decided that they wanted to have higher and higher test scores, and so they hired a lawyer, a prosecutor, a very well-known figure in San Diego, Alan Burson, who was a very respected guy, and he said, well, District 2 solved the problem, so he hired Tony Alvarado, brilliant educator from District 2, and then said, I want you to force the teachers in this district to do exactly what they have to do to close the achievement gap because you did it in District 2. Well, actually, they did not close the achievement gap in District 2. There was still a huge achievement gap, and San Diego, the teachers just felt beaten down. But that what happened in San Diego was very important because it then became the staging ground for New York City. And New York City takes the approach of Bloomberg and Klein. We have the answers. Let's do exactly what San Diego did. And so the District 2 story comes back to be, let's force everybody to do what they did in San Diego, which they didn't force everybody to do in District 2. But it sounds convoluted, but in fact the story is we end up with teachers disrespected and with this pretense that if we just focus on basic skills and push every teacher to and force them to do what they might or might not agree with, that somehow we will close the achievement gap. It's not happened, and we're still, we have a very disheartened teaching staff in New York City and now across the country, because what happened in New York City over the past 8 years turns out to be the mirror image of George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind Act.
I speak with Diane Ravitch, author of The Death and Life of the Great American School System. I guess this would get somewhat deep into educational wonkery, but just what is this balanced literacy? What are the various approaches to teaching children how to read, and which one does this embrace?
Well, balanced literacy is somewhat similar to whole language, and that is that you teach children strategies, and you say you learn to reflect on the text, think about the text. You do shared reading, you do guided reading, you do writing with a partner. There are just a variety of strategies. The way it was implemented in New York City was according to a script, and the script said, all right, you will now do 5 minutes of this, now you will do 15 minutes of that, now you will turn to your partner and you will do turn and talk. I mean, it got to be a kind of a ritualistic and very mechanistic approach to reading. And the kids chose their own books, which is fine sometimes, but where I saw the craziness of it was when I went out to interview people in San Diego, and I was talking to the woman who directed the program for the whole district, and she said, oh, it was so important that we had balanced literacy. She said, we had fourth graders who didn't understand the difference between perspective and point of view, and we had to teach it to them. So as I'm sitting there taking notes, I'm thinking, I don't know the difference between perspective and point of view either, but I'm not going to admit it because I would be stupider than a fourth grader, right?
Yeah, I was just feeling rather embarrassed myself. They sound fairly similar to me.
Yeah, right. So I don't know. I mean, it's basically a strategy of teaching reading. I'm sure it's fine for some kids, but it doesn't seem to be fine for all kids because the city of New York's been doing balanced literacy for 8 years, and it's never been able to get any bump up in its national test scores in reading.
A couple of interesting contradictions about all this. One is that despite all the talk of choice, there's actually quite a good deal of coercion and central control involved in all these experiments, right?
Well, the theory of choice is that the children are choosing schools, or the families are choosing schools. What actually happens with choice is that usually the schools are choosing the children. And so you get charter schools where they have a lottery, and those who win the lottery get in. But they're only getting kids who apply. So the families that are not smart enough or wise enough or informed enough to apply to a lottery, their kids stay in the public schools. And then the choice schools, of course, can also remove kids. They can deselect kids because their scores are not high enough or because they're troublesome or for whatever reason, they get dumped back into the regular public schools.
Yeah, well, actually, we have a four-year-old, and we're in the process of choosing schools now, and I've been struck by two things. One is that the New York City public schools are some of them are quite good, and there are very many dedicated and wonderful people teaching there, which is not what you'd get from the general public image. And the second thing is that, but it requires a lot of energy and knowledge and canniness to work the system.
Well, this is the great puzzle. I mean, first of all, you have to remember that there have always been wonderful public schools in New York City, and despite the complaints and rep, there have always been incredible teachers. In fact, very often the suburban districts, where their pay is much higher, have raided New York City because people in the districts outside the city know that New York City has great training, and if you go through several years in a New York City school, you can handle virtually anything. So there are many excellent schools, and there have always been many excellent schools. The problem in this city with choice is that it has become it's become a major project for parents to figure out how to make a choice, and it's also become a mechanism by which communities are destroyed, because the city administration is really trying to break up anything that reeks of a community high school or a community middle school. And so parents have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out where they can get in, which is the nature of choice. You can't get it, and you can't necessarily get in where you'd like to go. And so we have something like 400 high schools now, and you may have a middle school sending kids off to 30, 50, 100 different high schools.
Another contradiction of all this is that despite all the business people who like to think of themselves as data-driven, the actual results for many of their favorite techniques have been mediocre to disappointing, right? I mean, for example, charter schools, one of their beloved things. There's no evidence that charter schools really improve upon the performance of traditional public schools, is there?
Well, charter schools right now are the media's darling. They love to find a school and say, wow, look at this. There are actually poor kids or black kids or Hispanic kids, and they're learning, and they're going to go to college, as if black kids and Hispanic kids can't learn and wouldn't go to college. And it's not difficult to go into any community, no matter how poor it is, and to find kids who are motivated and who want to go to college, and to deselect those who turn out not to be motivated. And this is the story of charter schools: is they have a lottery, and they will end up with a very high rate of attrition. There was an evaluation of KIPP schools in the Bay Area that found that of the kids who started fifth grade, within 3 years, 60% of them were gone. Well, if you're only looking at the remaining kids and you're not replacing them, and they haven't been, then of course you have a higher performing cohort than the public school, which will have a higher percentage of limited English proficient kids, a higher percentage of special ed kids, a higher percentage of the kids who got thrown out of the charter school, and so that it's an unfair comparison. But overall, when you look at things like the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is the federal testing program, charter schools have never outperformed regular public schools. They have not, whether you're looking at black kids, Hispanic kids, or low-income kids, the charter schools don't do better because, on average, they're not better. And this is not to say that there aren't some good charter schools. There are some excellent charter schools, but on the whole, charter schools have not outperformed regular public schools.
Well, they're all excellent charter schools, but they're also excellent public schools.
Right, they're excellent public schools, and there are some totally dreadful charter schools. I mean, they're not all. The public has been led to believe by this media fascination with the extraordinary, you know, the anecdotal evidence that these are all typically extraordinary schools, and they're not. They range from excellent to horrible, just as public schools do, and they have just as many problems. The charter schools have the problem now that, as they expand, I believe that the quality will go down because there is, even today, just a small number of really excellent charter schools. So there are a small number of excellent charter school management organizations, and they will not be able to fill the Obama administration's expectation of creating thousands more charter schools.
Now let's talk about the evolution of No Child Left Behind. No one would ever confuse George Bush with an intellectual, but he's left this tremendous educational legacy behind him. Tell us about No Child Left Behind. What are the prominent features of it, and how's it worked out?
No Child Left Behind, first of all, it was passed by Congress in 2001, right after 9/11, and so the Congress was eager to show that it was unified and wanting to act on something, and it passed No Child Left Behind and created elaborate mathematical formulas about how to measure the progress of schools. And President George W. Bush signed it into law in January of 2002. No Child Left Behind says test everybody every year, every child every year, from third grade through eighth grade in math and reading. And then schools are expected, they break up the scores according to race and English language ability and low incomes and disability, a number of categories like that. And every one of these categories must make progress, must have higher test scores every year, or the school will be considered a failing school. And usually the group that makes the least progress or no progress will be the children with disabilities. So what's happened today, 8 years later, is we have about a third of all American public schools labeled, stigmatized as failing schools. Also, No Child Left Behind says that by the year 2014, 100% of all children will be proficient in reading and math. And so in the book, I say this is a timetable for the destruction of American public education, because it's a utopian goal. When they passed it, they knew that it would never be met. and now they're administering stigmatization and punishment based on this unreachable goal, because as the year 2014 gets closer, the bar goes higher, and more schools will be considered failing schools.
How useful or perceptive are these tests? Do they serve any function at all, or do they really distort the whole process?
Well, what's wrong with the test is attaching stakes to them. By saying that you're going to be punished if your scores don't go higher, it causes teachers, first of all, to narrow the curriculum. There's no point, really, in teaching history or geography or foreign language, anything. I mean, science, none of those things are tested, only reading and math. So this attaching stakes, attaching punishment and rewards to the test narrows the curriculum, and it also says to the teachers, you better teach to the test, study the test, see what was tested last year, teach that relentlessly. And so what the law has done is to create a multi-billion dollar industry of testing and test prep materials and tutoring, and the results have been very meager.
Yeah, but even by their own standards, they're not producing the kinds of progress on test scores that they'd hoped for.
Well, what they've done is that NCLB has encouraged the states to lie about progress. And so we have states reporting that 80% or 90% of their kids are proficient. New York State, by the way, is one of the states that lie. New York State has a trajectory that's almost, I don't know how you describe it, but it goes up, 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 year after year from 2006 to 2009, which is because 2006 is when we started doing testing for grades 3 through 8 to meet the requirements of the federal law. And so the scores have been flying through the ceiling. But then the national test scores come out, which are administered by the federal government. Nobody can prepare for them. And it turns out that New York State has not made any gains during that period at the same time that the scores were going up. And that's true of all the other states that are saying that 80 to 90% of their kids are proficient. They're doing this to try to meet the requirements of the law. But by, according to the national assessment, their scores are flat or their scores have gone up by a point or two. And instead of having 90% proficient, it's more like 25% or 29% or 30%. So we have a lot of institutional fraud going on right now.
We're listening to an interview with Diane Ravitch, author of The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, just published by Basic Books. Ravitch was once known as a high-profile conservative educational reformer. She served in the first Bush administration and was a fellow at the right-wing Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Several years ago, she rethought everything and has now emerged as a critic of the test-driven, privatization-obsessed approach to educational policy that is now not only the province of the right, but also of the Obama administration. The interview will continue after a station break and a musical interlude.
Behind the News with Doug Henwood, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
That was my four-year-old son, Ivan, the guy who made me take education policy personally. Back after this musical break. That was some of Steely Dan's My Old School. That was about Bard College, not the public school system. And now part two of the interview with Diane Ravitch, author of The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, just out from Basic Books.
This show is also heard in California. How does that state stack up?
Well, California, again, reports higher scores than the national assessment, but that's true everywhere. What has happened in California is that the governor, Governor Schwarzenegger, has stacked the state board with charter school supporters. He's just added more charter. I think the president of the state board is the head of the Charter School Association, and he's just added several charter school operators to the state board. So, it's crazy. California has something like 5% of its kids in charters, and yet the state board is a charter board. So we'll see more privatization of public education in California. And a lot of this has to do with No Child Left Behind, not only because one of the remedies for a so-called failing school is to charterize it, but because the very promise, the expectation that 100% of kids must be proficient by the year 2014 has delegitimated public education. Because schools can't meet this impossible goal, it creates the expectation, well, then let's turn to choice. Let's turn to charter schools. Maybe the market, maybe the business community knows how to have this 100% proficiency.
But this assault on the public school system is striking, given that the United States was one of the pioneers in broad public education. You're a historian of education. How does this attack on public schools stack up against American history?
Well, it's very sad because the public school system has always been one of the treasures of the American democratic system. And what we've seen over the last decade is a steady assault on public education. It's turned from an assault on public education to an assault on teachers. And we now have we now have things like the cover of Newsweek that ran a couple of weeks ago saying the key to saving American education is to fire bad teachers, as though our schools are overrun with bad teachers, and if we can just fire enough of them, we can make things better. The story itself said that the real solution is to get rid of public education, just like New Orleans did, and replace public schools with non-union charter schools where teachers can be fired at will. The story admitted that these non-union charter schools rely on teachers, young kids, who come in and work 60, 70, 80 hours a week, burn out in 2 or 3 years and are gone, and then are replaced by yet another cadre. Well, this is insanity. We have a teaching force of over 3 million teachers. They're professionals. They have lives. They have children. They have families. They can't work 60 or 70, 80 hours a week. And the unions are not the problem. I mean, part of the thesis of the Newsweek article was that the unions stand in the way of having good schools. And if this were true, Massachusetts would not be the highest performing state in the nation, and Finland would not be the highest performing nation in the world. Finland is 100% union, and Massachusetts is 100% union. And yet the mantra that is now coming from many sources, including the Obama administration, building on the legacy of the Bush administration, is that our biggest problem is bad teachers and teachers' unions.
It seems that from reading the book and from this conversation that a lot of these educational reformers, and you actually write some interesting stuff about this, the transformation of the word reform and reformer, but a lot of these reformers are much more concerned about technique than content. What is it in the curriculum now? I mean, what do people teach as opposed to how do people teach it?
Actually, the reformers, some of the bloggers refer to them, by the way, as deformers, but the reformers are not interested in curriculum or instruction. They're only interested in organization, in management, and creating incentives and sanctions. They totally have bought into the idea that if you have the right incentives, you can produce better schools. And so they only care about math and reading scores, and they want merit pay because they'll incentivize teachers to work harder. They're assuming teachers are not working hard, and so they will incentivize teachers to compete with one another for higher scores, and they will sanction them. They'll close the schools and fire the staff if they're not getting higher scores. And this is the fundamental reform mantra, which has nothing whatever to do with curriculum instruction. They will frequently say to you, I know nothing about curriculum instruction, but I know about management, and I know about the importance of incentives and sanctions.
Yeah, some of the more prominent reformers, the fellow in San Diego and Joel Klein in New York, are lawyers. They're not educators. And is this part of the idea that they're bringing in outsiders to shake up what they see as an ossified establishment?
Right. And in their case, they both tried to do the curriculum piece, or not curriculum, they tried to do the instructional piece because they thought if they could just make everybody do the right math program and make everybody do the right reading program. But they pretty much gave up on the curriculum instruction piece, firstly because they didn't know much about it, but secondly because they became persuaded by especially the Broad Foundation and the Gates Foundation that the answers to fixing the schools lay in organization, management, and firing bad teachers.
Yeah, you mentioned these foundations. They're very important players in all this transformation of the American school system. Who are they, and what's their mission?
Well, I have a chapter called the Billionaire Boys Club, and I began with a sort of a background of the role of foundations in American history. And it used to be that foundations had somewhat limited ambitions, but important ambitions. So you had the guy from the Rosenwald Fund creating thousands and thousands of schools for black children in the South at a time when the South was unwilling to educate black children at all. And the Ford Foundation got burned in New York City by trying to inject itself into school issues. But then the Annenberg Fund came up with $500 million to help schools do better things, and that didn't produce any results. So now we have today a series of foundations who actually want to change American education. And the point that I wanted to make was these foundations exist within our democratic society demanding accountability, but they themselves are accountable to no one. There is no democratic accountability for them. If they make a mistake, they don't even have to say, I'm sorry. The biggest foundation right now is the Gates Foundation, but I begin the story of the modern foundation and its ambitions with the Walton Family Foundation. The Walton Family Foundation has devoted many millions of dollars to promoting choice, vouchers, charter schools. Anybody who supports choice is likely to be funded by the Walton Family Foundation, which is the Walmart family in Arkansas. They don't give very much to public schools. They give a few pennies to public schools, but many millions to promote choice. And that's their philosophy. They believe in the marketplace. They believe in consumerism. Then I follow with a discussion of the Gates Foundation, which is obviously the biggest in the country, if not the world. And the Gates Foundation tried to push the idea of small schools, which they pumped $2 billion into. Sorry, not 2 million, $2 billion into small schools. And then decided that that wasn't working out, so they just dropped that, and now they moved on to the answer to everything is teacher evaluation and replicating charter schools. So they're pumping tons of money into charters, and also their big focus now is teacher evaluation, because they have bought this idea that if we could evaluate enough teachers and throw out enough bad teachers, we will have the key to transforming education. The Broad Foundation has pretty much followed on the same trajectory is the Gates Foundation. It's all about teacher evaluation. The Broad Foundation has done one other thing, which is that they train superintendents, and they train them in their idea of what the business approach is. And wherever you see a Broad-trained superintendent, you will find somebody who is closing public schools and opening charter schools and trying to create a marketplace of choices.
It's funny that the Gates Foundation, you know, would be seen as liberal. I guess the Walton Foundation would be seen as conservative, yet there's a remarkable harmony between the two sides.
Well, I guess the Gates Foundation would probably recoil at the notion, but they've ended up pretty much in the same spot. They're doing very little to improve public education. They would probably say, our teacher evaluation piece is critical. But the teacher evaluation emphasis has turned into what I consider a red herring. The red herring being this idea that bad teachers are at the root of our educational problems. It just underlines the emphasis on ignoring all the social causes of low achievement. To treat the teachers as responsible for low achievement when we know from decades and decades of social science research that the single best predictor of low achievement is poverty.
Their approach to detecting bad teachers, though, is almost entirely testing-based, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they have bought, I mean, I describe in Chapter 9 of the book, which is about teachers, I describe how various economists have come up with formulas saying that they now know what makes a good teacher, and it's not experience, it's not their education, it's not their credentials, it's simply that they produced higher test scores. And so they theorize that if a child were to have three great teachers in a row, or four great teachers in a row, or five great teachers in a row, depending on which economist you're reading, the achievement gap would completely close. And I've talked to some of these economists, and I've asked if they could point me to a district where this theory has been worked out, and it turns out there is none. This is simply speculation. But this speculation has now been absorbed and accepted by the Obama administration, the Gates Foundation, the Broad Foundation, the Education Trust. I mean, any number of, it's like this is now the mantra of the think tanks, the editorial boards. I mean, there is this, what I think of as the dominant consensus, and it's the foundations, the think tanks which are funded by the foundations, the editorial boards, which read the reports of the think tanks, the corporate suites, which read the same, which read the editorials, and they've all joined hands and they're singing "Kumbaya" and saying, "Get rid of the unions and let's replace everything with non-union charter schools, and get rid of bad teachers and we'll have better schools."
You cite one study on teacher evaluation that shows that one's fifth grade teacher has a very strong influence on one's performance in third and fourth grade, which of course is impossible. What does that tell you?
Well, that says that all of this, what they're calling value-added assessment, which is, this was a test of value-added assessment, and it's now what the Obama administration is promoting, that it's bunk. It's not ready for prime time. This was a study done by an economist named Jesse Rothstein, who's at Berkeley, and I think he's on loan right now to the federal government, but he's not working in the education area. And what Rothstein showed was that you could use these calculations of, did you make growth in this grade or that grade, and attribute it to the wrong teacher. There have been other studies that show that a teacher who gets big gains one year may not get them the next year. So one year she's a great teacher, the next year she's not a great teacher, and that it's a lot of it depends on which kids end up in your class, and children are not randomly assigned. Teachers don't have the same percentage of kids from different demographic groups in their class, and so it's pretty much the luck of the draw whether you're going to be a great teacher or not a great teacher. And it's also, this whole calculation is somewhat, I think of it as insane, because since you can't predict who's going to be a great teacher until you see the test scores, you probably can't reliably say for 5 years who the great teachers are, and then you replace the non-great teachers with people who've never taught at all. It sounds like we'll just be spinning our wheels for decades trying to figure out how to do this according to the econometric projections.
I'm speaking with Diane Ravitch, author of The Death and Life of the Great American School System, just out from Basic Books. Now, you've alluded to this several times, but let's go into some more detail. What has the Obama administration done with No Child Left Behind? They have their Race to the Top.
Well, race to the Top has gotten a lot of ink. Something like 40 or 41 states put in detailed applications seeking funding. We're in like a tsunami for education right now. Everybody is in a budget crisis because of the recession, and so the federal government comes forward with $5 billion, which comes right out of the Economic Stimulus Fund, and therefore no one in Congress ever authorized its use for this purpose. But the Obama administration decided right off the bat that it would dangle this money before the states and say, we are going to award points, A, if you lift your cap on charter schools, create more privately managed charter schools, and B, if you have teacher evaluation where the teachers will be evaluated by their student test scores. These are policies right out of the GOP playbook, and I have never understood why the Obama administration decided that the Democratic policy was not its policy, but the Republican policy sounded pretty good. They actually hired someone to run the Race to the Top Fund, who comes from the Californians will recognize it, the New Schools Venture Fund, whose purpose is to create charter management organizations and encourage the spread of charters. So since, there's a kind of a symbiosis there where the administration has committed itself to choice and accountability as its policy.
Yeah, what happened? We had Arne Duncan applauding the effects of Hurricane Katrina on the New Orleans school system in words almost indistinguishable from those of Milton Friedman. We have the president himself applauding the firing of the teaching staff at Central Falls High School in Rhode Island, and going after the teachers union in a way that you'd never expect out of a Democratic president. Do you have any understanding of what's going on?
Well, I certainly don't. I mean, it's part of what I tried to write in the book is that the Democratic Party has lost its way, it's lost its agenda, and we now have a bipartisan policy that is exactly what Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush would have done if they were in office today. The Race to the Top goes way beyond George W. Bush's greatest expectations, Margaret Spelling's praise to the skies. Duncan was out campaigning with Newt Gingrich and Al Sharpton, saying that this was the agenda that would, transform American education. He's gotten praise from the New York Times, all the major editorial boards, and it's very much in sync with what the Gates Foundation, the Broad Foundation, and even the Walton Foundation want, because it's the Republican agenda. It's choice and accountability, more charter schools and firing teachers and closing schools.
Since there's so little empirical evidence really to support this agenda, what is really driving it? Is it ideology? Is there a material interest in cutting education spending, and then busting teachers' unions would be a way of doing that? What is really driving this this obsession?
Well, I have to assume that I mean, I don't understand where President Obama and Secretary Duncan are coming from. I mean, they seem like reasonable men, and yet they have signed on to an agenda that is the same. I mean, I used to be associated with the Hoover Institution, and this is the same agenda that was being promoted by the most fervent advocates of choice and accountability on the right. So how it migrated into the Obama administration is very puzzling to me, and I don't understand, and I can't explain it.
Is there anybody in politics with any kind of power or following that's challenging this, or is it now completely dominant?
Well, I think that had Ted Kennedy lived, maybe he would have, but unfortunately Ted Kennedy was one of the biggest boosters of No Child Left Behind, and to his last days, he always complained there wasn't enough money. But the problem with No Child Left Behind was not money. It was the vision itself was the wrong vision. What it did to the schools was terrible. I mean, since my book came out a month ago, I've had literally hundreds of emails from teachers talking about how they've had to narrow their teaching and how the kids are being bored to death by being drilled endlessly on basic skills, and how a culture of testing and test prep has taken over our schools. And, you know, I can't say if Teddy Kennedy were alive, maybe, but there's been no one to take his place. And I've been out on the road talking about the issues, and invariably somebody says to me, who is our leader? Who in Congress can we turn to? I wish I knew that person. I would like to find that person. I would like to find the person who would stand up and say, don't take the race to the top. Money, you're being bribed to do the wrong thing. Don't compete for money that's sending you in the wrong direction. But so far I've not heard that, and I'm hoping that as the debate moves forward on the proposals to reauthorize No Child Left Behind, changing its name and dropping the deadline, that someone in Congress, some senator or some congressman, will step up to the plate and say, this is not good education. This is not what the Democratic Party has ever believed in, and we're not going to do it.
And the curriculum now being transformed, people don't read literature. It's all about reading skills in a very technical manner, and art and music falling out of the curriculum. History really suffering as well?
Oh, well, yeah. And, you know, what defenders of this policy will say is, well, we don't have the evidence. But, you know, the evidence is that the people who believe in incentives should listen to their own lingo. They are incentivizing teachers to do nothing but teach the test. They're incentivizing teachers and saying your salary and your tenure and your everything, your life in the school and the survival of your school depends on reading scores and math scores. There is no incentive to teach the arts or science or history or geography or civics or anything else. No foreign languages certainly is incentivized. So if you believe in incentives, as these guys do, they should listen to their own lingo and see how they have incentivized the workforce. And it's going to dumb down education in this country for a generation.
Let's, as we're reaching the end of this, turn towards how might be a better way of doing things. You mentioned Finland earlier as a country that does very well in international comparisons. What is it about the Finnish educational system that provides, well, one, Finland is a country with a relatively more egalitarian income distribution, which probably has something to do with it, but what about Finnish education produces these fine results?
Well, you know, Finland is also unlike us demographically. It's very homogeneous and it has a very small population, but it does have one, there, you could say that of many countries, but what has distinguished Finnish education is they have put a huge emphasis on having a great teacher corps. And young people compete to become teachers because teachers are well-educated, well-prepared to become teachers. When they are inducted into the teaching corps, there's a lot of support for becoming a good teacher, a lot of help from a more experienced teacher, and they're well-paid and they're highly respected. And I've talked to people in Finland, and I met recently with a Finnish representative to the European International Teachers Group, and the big story is the teachers. Not about firing teachers, but about changing the intake of teachers. And I think that I think the last 8 years on No Child Left Behind were wasted and destructive. I would hate to see us waste another 8 years. We should begin having a program right now to plan for the change in American education that might take 10 to 15 years, beginning with improving our intake of teachers and supporting the teachers we have, making them better. If they're really horrible teachers, of course they should be fired, but they shouldn't be fired without having a hearing. So, starting with good teachers, but secondly, we should have principals who are themselves master teachers. We're asking principals to evaluate the teachers. They should be master teachers themselves or they can't do the evaluation. The principals are the ones who make the crucial decision about personnel. Furthermore, this move towards having superintendents who are lawyers and businessmen and admirals and generals is ridiculous. We should have superintendents who know enough about education to be able to make good decisions about curriculum and instruction and personnel, because they're the guys making the most crucial decisions. So I think we need a more professional education core. That's a good start. And we need to change our assessments away from the bubble test to tests that really test knowledge and understanding. And that we got a lot of work to do on that. Arnie Duncan goes around the country and says, our tests are no good. Now let's judge teachers based on whether they raise scores on lousy tests. We need better tests. We need tests that really encourage good teaching and also the kind of learning where kids come out knowing something and able to explain what they've learned rather than to just pick a bubble.
And the Finns don't really test very much, right?
No, the Finns don't do the kind of testing we do. There's an exit exam or an exam for placement in college, but they don't do the annual testing that we do. Testing is not very important. Good instruction and good curriculum is important there. And they have a curriculum that includes the arts and science and all the good things that you would find in the very finest private schools. That's what they have in their public schools. That's what we should have in our public schools.
Well, it's interesting that the business elite and the political elite don't send their kids to these kinds of public schools. They send their kids to elite private schools that have a fairly traditional curriculum. What kind of curriculum would you see as better than what all this reform is pushing?
Well, the current era of reform is starving the curriculum. It's ignoring the curriculum and saying that all you need is basic skills, which is crazy. Our schools, our public schools, should have a curriculum that, beginning in the earliest grades, that includes history and geography and civics and literature, really good literature for children age-appropriate, economics, the sciences, the arts. I think the arts are critical. I was asked at some point which federal mandates I approved of, and I said the one I would like to see doesn't exist, and that would be that every child should have the opportunity to play a musical instrument, and I think that would be a brilliant mandate, because then in learning to play a musical instrument, you learn practice, self-discipline, you learn to work alone, you learn to work in a team. I mean, and you have reason to come to school, because that's a glorious thing to do and a lifelong achievement. So I think that we need to have that kind of broad, rich, deep, engaging, mind-expanding curriculum, or where when the kids leave school, they have lots of choices in their lives. They can choose to go into college. They can choose to go to work. But at least they're prepared for a life and not just for test-taking skills.
What kind of reception are you getting? You must be talking to a lot of people. You've said a little bit about this, but does this resonate with parents and the broad population?
I've had, Doug, the most incredible reaction to this book, and I thought it was going to be an important book because it's so much out of the mainstream. The mainstream is very much focused on test scores, and what's happened is that this book has become the counter-narrative, and I've gotten hundreds of letters, emails from teachers and from parents, basically saying either thank you or help, my district is destroying our schools. Help, everything you described is happening here. Can you come here and can you come to Central Falls? Can you come to Florida? Can you testify against this outrageous legislation that's going to destroy the teaching profession? Help come say. But basically it's been amazing. And this coming, Sunday of April 11th, I guess it is, the book will appear on the New York Times bestseller list at number 16. And the most exciting thing I heard, other than that, was that my publisher told me that on the first day in which the iPad was released, that my book was the number one seller for the Perseus Group, and they were very impressed because it outsold Raquel Welch.
That's a very great achievement.
And so I was thinking, wow, now that's an achievement. But the most exciting and most rewarding thing has been hearing from teachers who say, at last there's someone who understands that we're dealing with kids from all different kinds of backgrounds. We cannot, when kids come in reading at a third grade level and I'm teaching 10th grade, I'm not going to get them to 100% proficiency. We need understanding as much as we need resources, and we don't even have understanding of what we're dealing with.
That was Diane Ravitch, author of The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, just out from Basic Books. Ravitch was once a high-profile conservative educational reformer who has now turned on her old colleagues and emerged as a critic of that nasty and toxic agenda. I worry that these educational reforms, coming from the likes of Bush, Obama, Bloomberg, Schwarzenegger, Gates, and Walton, a mix of Dems and Republicans, corporate liberals, centrist technocrats, and hardcore conservatives, will make this country even dumber and meaner in the coming years. And aside from a few people like Ravitch and Debbie Meyer and Monty Neal, who've also been on this show, there's almost no prominent opposition to this horrifying agenda. Anti-intellectualism is as American as apple pie and gun ownership, but this gang has, as they say, taken it to a new level. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of In the Mind of the Bourgeois Reader from Sonic Youth. Till next week, bye.